Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments.
Good afternoon, everybody. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to the Vox Pop for this Monday, August 20th. I'm Alan Chartok. Support for Medical Monday comes from Saratoga Hospital, an affiliate of Albany Med. Saratoga Hospital, with more than 20 locations across the greater Saratoga region. People you trust, care you deserve, saratogahospital.org. Joining us this afternoon, one of my best friends, a guy who I really like, is Dr. Mark Pettis of Berkshire Health Systems. He's here to answer your questions about general health and medical education. We always get a lot of calls on this program, so get yours in early. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Dr. Pettis, your calls, much more, all coming up on the Vox Pop right after this news. Hello once again and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us on this Medical Monday is Dr. Mark Pettis of Berkshire Health Systems. Dr. Pettis is a triple board certified internist, nephrologist, and integrative medicine physician practicing for more than 25 years. He is the Director of Medical Education, Wellness, and Population Health at BHS. Dr. Pettis also serves as the Associate Dean of Medical Education at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. He's the author of two books, The Savvy Patient, The Ultimate Advocate for Quality Health Care, and It's All in Your Head, Change Your Mind, Change Your Health. He serves on the teaching faculty at the Center for Mind-Body Medicine based in Washington, D.C., and the Meditation Institute in Averill Park, New York. Mark Pettis, my old friend, thank you so much for being back on Medical Monday.
Great to be with you, Alan.
Well, it's terrific that you're doing all of this great work. You started as a nephrologist, and then you've done all these other things. So why don't you teach us all how to, you know, relax? How do you do that?
When you look at stress and how revved up people are these days, Alan, it is one of the major drivers of poor quality of life and health issues. It impacts sleep. It revs up our immune system. So we have to try harder as modern humans to unplug. And some of that requires just making time to disconnect. Some of it requires learning some simple techniques, breathing techniques, a little guided imagery, focusing on sleep quality, but it can be a real challenge.
Well, why don't we just take a few seconds to go into some of those, like sleep quality. What do you want us to do?
Well, so you know, as many as 40% of American adults will not wake up feeling rested and restored in the morning. And while there are many reasons for that, a big area of research now, Alan, is what is falls into the category of circadian rhythm, circadian entrainment. How synchronized our circadian rhythms are with nature, with the environment, and because most of us spend little time outdoors. And we are in indoor, artificially lit environments. And if you look at the quality of those artificial lights, they do not mimic full spectrum light. So one of the reasons that we are not synchronized is the quality of the light in our environment. So some simple things people can do is to try to get out more during the day, particularly in the early morning hours. Late in the day, late afternoon, early evening, that sun is beautiful and it's orange, red, end of the color spectrum. And generally, I recommend people use what are called blue blocker filters. A lot of our smartphones, our tablets, our laptops emit a lot of blue light. And blue light is really early morning light. It tells us that it's time to get up and get ready to hunt and gather. When you're getting a lot of blue light at the end of the day, it may be 10 p.m. and your brain thinks it's 8 in the morning. Mm. So many smartphones and laptops have filters built in now. Apple's is called Night Shift. A good product that one can download is called Iris. And these will automatically filter out blue light on those devices. And that can be very, very helpful. Some people wear, and I will wear, blue blocker glasses. These are just simple $10 glasses that have amber colored lens to sort of filter out that blue light. And if I'm in an artificially lit environment, particularly late into the evening, I'll put blue blocker glasses on, and that'll filter that out.
And Mark, will that wake you up in the middle of the night like I do? I mean, I could sleep for 3 hours, 4 hours, and then I'm up for another hour or so.
Yeah, I mean, I think the schedule that you have, Alan, is a lot like night shift work. So your circadian rhythms are going to vary a little bit because of that. So lighting is really important for you early in that evening hour, not getting a lot of blue light to allow you to sleep for longer periods of time.
Okay, so we'll go to Jim in Matamoros. Okay, Jim, you're on. Go ahead.
With relative climate changes and dietary changes, are you seeing an apparent increase in infectious disease versus metabolic disease?
Yeah, that's a good question, Jim. I think in general, when you look at the epidemiology of chronic complex diseases that are so common now, from obesity to diabetes, to heart disease, to cancer, most of these are non-infectious diseases. And there's been a dramatic shift over the last 100 years in what predominantly at the turn of the 20th century were infectious diseases that shortened our lives. And that has really shifted to what are largely metabolic diseases. Infectious diseases are still a problem, particularly if you look at tick-borne diseases like Lyme and some of Lyme's cousins like babesiosis and anaplasmosis. These are going up in prevalence, and it's very concerning when you look at how prevalent they are. But for the most part, what threatens most people over their lifetime these days are metabolic diseases.
And again, just for the definition, what's the difference between metabolic and
infectious? Yeah, so an infectious disease would be something caused usually by a bacteria or a virus. And one has an exposure, they become infected, and their illness, which usually will be short-lived and self-limited, will run its course. Metabolic diseases, on the other hand, tend to be chronic and progressive. And when the metabolism is altered, and I would think of a good example of that, Alan, would be inflammation, which is a metabolic landscape where the immune system is more hyperactive. It's more hypervigilant. It's not getting the downtime that it has evolved to get. So many people with chronic diseases have a lot of inflammation, as an example.
Great. Thank you, Jim. All right. We're going to go now to, it would be, Bob in Albany, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Bob in Albany, go.
Good afternoon.
Hey, Bob.
I'm wondering if the doctor could comment on the dismal state of organ donorship in New York and on any efforts that he's aware of to improve the situation.
Yeah, another good question. And while I'm not as privy to some of the New York-specific statistics, Bob, I think it can be said that nationwide, the number of individuals waiting for an organ transplant, kidney transplants being the most common, continued to go up. And average wait times can be as long as 3 to 5 years. Yeah. The same can be said for liver transplants. And there simply are not a sufficient number of donors to keep pace with the number of people whose organs are failing and who ultimately need a transplant. To that end, there have been some shifts that have included options like a living unrelated donor. This might be a spouse or even in some instances a close friend. If the genetic compatibility is sufficient, one can broaden the pool of potential donors. There's a lot of research, though it hasn't evolved to the point of prime time, looking at stem cells, artificial organs. But this is a real problem, and I suspect it's going to get worse.
Picture a bit. New York has the lowest rate of organ donorship in the entire country.
It does. Yeah, I was not aware of that.
Which is funny to me.
Yeah.
And people die for lack of livers and kidneys at a higher rate in New York State than virtually anywhere else in the country, which is mind-boggling.
Yeah, I was not aware of that, Bob. That's a really interesting point. You know, there have been a lot of efforts to get potential organ donors to declare that on their licenses. But I can tell you in my experience, when someone has a catastrophic event in their lives, even when they make clear their desire to be a donor, their proxy or their loved one may struggle with that decision in that moment. Mm-hmm. And it's a real problem.
Okay, Bob, thank you very much. We're going to take a short break. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. The first person to dial that number gets on the air, because no one else is. We expect that you will do that. We want you to do that. Okay, 1-800-348-2551. Okay, we're on with Dr. Mark Pettis, who's one of the brightest guys I know, works for Berkshire Health Systems, and we are talking anything you want to talk about. He's an internist, he's a nephrologist, he's an expert in integrative medicine, he's a top professor at medical schools. You want it? You want some interesting stuff? We'll do it for you. As I promised, the first one on, and that is Andrea of Niskayuna, and we'll go to Andrea in Niskayuna. You're on.
Hi there. I wanted to second what the last caller spoke about. I read the same article in the New York Times, and New York was appallingly bad. And I wanted to suggest that a lot more, that's what he was asking, what can be done. A lot more can be done. And I think, for me, I'm an ambassador. I donated a kidney 3.5 years ago. I was in my 60s at the time. And 5 months later, I did my 8th Grand Canyon rim-to-rim hike, 25 miles. It is not a big deal. I was out of the hospital in 2 days and back in business in a couple of weeks. So I really encourage people, if they have a loved one or a friend, to just step up and do it. It is not a big deal. And the matching process is far less complex than it was 30 years ago. New medications and new ways of matching have changed the landscape tremendously.
Okay, Mark, any reaction?
That's a great comment, Andrea. Thank you. I do think education and just awareness of how safe and how profound the gift of a transplant can be is important, and people don't fully appreciate that. Thank you.
And one great way to think about it is, what would I want if I needed one?
Well, exactly.
Absolutely. Yes. And I actually want to make one other point. I bumped into a doctor, a physician, on my hike that particular year, my 8th hike, and he saw my medical alert necklace, because I have to wear it because I can't take certain medications, which is not a big deal. I wasn't planning to take them anyway. And he said, well, why are you here? And I said, because I want to be. And he said that doctors lie and that people who donate organs are in all kinds of danger. And in fact, the statistics show that the screening process is so good that donors live longer than the average person.
Andrea,
my comment.
Thank you very much for your comment. Bye. All right, and now on to Karen in Monterey, but not before I give that number, 1-800-348-2551. Karen, you're on.
Hi, thank you. Thank you, Alan. I don't know if this is in your purview, but I've had dry eye for years and have seen all kinds of doctors, but not none that have worked. Mm. And I wonder, I've Googled, so putting that aside, how do you find a specialist who really is top of the line for dry eye or for anything but certainly that?
Yeah. Well, so in my experience, Karen, while most people will start with their primary care providers, and sometimes these can be an issue of simply not making enough natural tears that can respond to, some artificial replacement.
I don't mean to cut you off, but I've done all of that.
Yeah. Yeah. So there are occasionally autoimmune problems that can create dry eyes as a predominant symptom, and the most widely described is what is called Sjogren's.
Yep, I've been tested for that.
And generally, the testing involves measuring antibodies in the blood, and an ophthalmologist would measure your tear production.
And all that.
And so, beyond that, hard to know. Nothing off the top of my head other than things that you've probably already thought about, which would include some allergies, some things in the environment that could be creating some inflammation in the eyes. And sometimes these can be subtle. Like
It started after I had cataract surgery, which I know is not uncommon. And so I'm looking how to find a specialist. I have a wonderful eye doctor, but she's the first one to say she has no idea where to go. And I've seen many doctors. So
I'm not sure where I could guide you beyond an ophthalmologist. Okay. Sorry about that.
Thanks, Karen. Okay, and now on to, let's see here. Yeah, definitely. It's Martin in Cahoes. Martin in Cahoes, you're on.
Hi.
Hi, Martin.
I'm in a situation, and this seems to be an opportune moment to call for a second opinion. Thank you for your show, Alan and Doctor. I tore my Achilles tendon a week ago this past Sunday. I went to see the capital orthopedists, and I saw a physician's assistant and told me it was completely detached, and I get an appointment to see the orthopedic surgeon next Friday. Now, I'm feeling it pretty bad. It hurts like heck, and now it'll be almost 2 weeks next Friday when I'm going to see this orthopedic surgeon, and I'm feeling this Achilles tendon moving up my calf, and it burns like hell. And they wouldn't give me any pain medication, so I'm just taking Motrin and Tylenol and keeping my foot elevated. And I'm wondering if this tendon is even going to be viable for being fixed by the time next Friday comes around. What's your opinion, sir?
Well, it's a tough injury, no question, and it can be a very painful injury. And when the entire tendon is severed, there's absolutely no option short of surgically reattaching the ends of that to restore full function of your Achilles, which, of course, you would need to have full function of your foot, ankle, and leg. I wouldn't be concerned that having a 2+ week delay between the injury and ultimately seeing an orthopedic surgeon would in any way interfere with that surgeon's ability to adequately repair the tear. It's an issue really of your comfort in the interim, and I would suggest time is on your side, but it's an injury that can take quite a long time to fully rehabilitate from, even after surgery.
Yeah, you can. What should he do? I mean, he has to just wait, right?
It's a waiting game, yeah. Intermittent ice and anti-inflammatories, obviously limited weight bearing until you can get it addressed.
All right, well, I'm glad to hear that the time period of 2 weeks is not going to inhibit the ability to repair it.
It will not, for sure.
Thank you, Martin. Okay, and now on to Suzanne in Warwick, New York. Suzanne, you're on.
Hello.
Hey.
Can you hear me?
Absolutely.
Yes.
So I'm going to pronounce it wrong, but you were talking about Lyme disease and babesia or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And about 6 months ago, my husband was diagnosed with it. He had a routine blood test at his checkup. And then they said, come back and be retested. And he came back, whatever it was, 2 months later and was retested. And they basically said to him, we don't know what the person before you was talking about. You don't have that. And I wanted to know, A, what it is and what the symptoms are and the dangers are. And B, is that possible or are they just disorganized at this doctor's office?
Well, Lyme testing can be a bit controversial and at the very least imperfect. The tests that we have available to us generally are done on people who have symptoms, and symptoms for Lyme vary, and they can feel flu-like. A person may have some fevers.
Babesia thing that they said he had, not Lyme.
Yeah, well, babesiosa often is accompanied by the same tick that causes Lyme. But generally, these are febrile illnesses where you have a fever. You may have some malaise, loss of energy, muscle aches. Many people can get pain in their joints with that. And so testing involves checking the blood for antibodies, the immune system's response to Babesia, and usually it is done with Lyme because they often coexist. It can take up to a month, sometimes 6 weeks, for the test to turn positive. So if somebody has symptoms, they've had a tick bite or an exposure, and the blood testing is negative initially, often you will want to repeat it in about 4 weeks, and frequently they will convert to a positive test at that time. A negative test is a negative test. There would be no antibodies in the blood to Babesia, and a repeat test at 4 to 6 weeks, if negative, would be very reassuring. So I'm not sure how to explain the confusion that they may have seen in the blood test, but it should have been relatively straightforward.
And if it goes untreated, what are the dangers? Is it the same as Lyme disease, which I'm pretty aware of?
I think we don't know quite as much about Babesia as we do Lyme disease, but, most of these will be self-limited. A person may feel down and out for a couple of weeks, and then they fully heal 100%. That would be the majority of the time. To my knowledge, the longer-term symptoms one sees with Lyme are less common with Babesia.
Thank you, Suzanne. And we'll go now to Anne in Albany. Anne in Albany, thanks for your patience. Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a quick question for the doctor. I'm wondering, since he mentioned he was involved in medical education, if he can just answer a simple question. What is the amount of education or time spent in education in nutrition, in the area of nutrition for new doctors? It seems to me as though seasoned doctors may not have had an awful lot of it. So I'm wondering if we've perhaps included a little bit more substance for newer doctors.
That's a really important question, Anne. And sadly, the amount of nutrition education that medical students get in the 4 years there in medical school, as well as what residents get, and this is after medical school, and that can be anywhere from 3 to 5 years, depending on the specialty of the physician. Generally, there is still very limited amount of nutritional education. I would say for most medical schools in the U.S., it probably averages less than a week,
wow,
which is stunning.
Wow.
And I had to totally educate myself, and I think most physicians these days that acquire an interest in nutrition and want to apply it more in their work have to educate themselves. And there are a lot of ways to do that, but there is still a huge disconnect between not just nutrition, but physicians still learn very little about environmental toxins. They still do not get a lot of training in things like meditation. There's still a significant gap. I think it's closing some, but it's still a problem.
You know, my friend Paul Lemansky, who is here quite frequently, has an MS in nutrition and on top of his medical degree.
Yes.
And he's a rare bird.
Yeah. Yeah. Unless somebody had a very specific degree in nutrition, it would be unusual to acquire that along the way. It's a sad commentary on our medical education enterprise.
Thanks, Ann. Okay, 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. And now we go to, of all places, Michael in Pittsfield. Okay, Michael, you're on.
Yes, hi. I've asked the doctor what he thinks is driving the subclinical inflammation that's leading to this pandemic of chronic disease that is assaulting us, and how to stop that inflammation.
Mm. It's a huge question, Michael. And off the top, I would say that we've had a growing disconnect over the last generation or two between many things in our environment as compared to that which our ancient ancestors were more accustomed to. So examples of that would be our food supply. We have so many processed foods in our food supply, particularly high in sugar and flour, what I often refer to as carbohydrate-dense foods. Those are major drivers of inflammation. Other changes in our food supply has been this incredible increase in processed vegetable oils as compared to more natural forms of fat that you might get in eggs or butter or grass-fed dairy. And we know
does
that
I'm sorry, Mark, but does that include olive oil?
That would not include olive oil. Okay. So the processed vegetable oils are things like safflower, corn oil, soybean oil, canola oil. We call them omega-6 fats, and we need omega-6, but the problem is we get way too much relative to the omega-3, which one would get in fatty fish like salmon, trout, sardines. So that's a driver of inflammation.
And on the other hand, Mark, maybe I could just argue with you
please.
For a second, and that is we have people are living into their 80s and 90s now, and our ancestors in the good old days were living to 30 and 40 years old. So we're doing some right?
Well, you know, when you look at mortality rates and more ancestral, it's infant mortality that brings down the average life expectancy. And most of the things that are driven are longevity over the last 100 years have been public health initiatives that have created cleaner water, vaccinations. We're not dying of those infectious diseases. So now we're living longer as a consequence, but we're living longer with an unprecedented burden of chronic complex disease. So those are a handful of things creating inflammation. And the one last thing I'll say is we don't get enough fiber in our diet, and we know that the biome, the gut, these organisms in the gut require fiber to maintain their diversity, and inflammation will occur when that diversity is lost.
Meaning eat what?
These would be plant-based foods, predominantly vegetables. Some fruits would be the greatest sources.
Okay, thank you, Michael. Okay, now we are going, of all places, to Allie in Albany. Allie in Albany, you're on.
Hello.
Hello.
I have a question. Hi, thank you. About polycystic kidney disease.
Yes.
I'm just curious if you could speak to kind of the long-term outlook for a 37-year-old male who's currently on dialysis with PKD and hopefully getting a kidney transplant within a year from a family friend. But we understand that he may need more transplants in the future. If you could speak a little bit about what the long term looks like.
Okay, Mark, and could you tell us what it is?
So autosomal dominant polycystic kidney disease is one of the few genetic diseases that causes the kidneys to fail. Mm. And it's a dominant gene. So generally the person will have inherited it from mother or father and has a 50% likelihood of their kidneys failing over time.
Wow.
Most people with polycystic kidney disease are otherwise healthy, except for how these cysts are affecting their kidneys. So transplant is the way to go. And I've seen people with polycystic kidney disease get transplants that have done well for 25, 30 plus years. There is a risk of recurrence in a transplanted kidney. But my understanding of the literature and the research now is that risk is relatively modest. And so generally, people would do quite well with the transplant.
So now with the coming of genetic, transplants and interferences, can we look forward to a time when something like being born with this particular predominant gene gets replaced?
I think so. In a future state, and as we get better, particularly with something like this, with technology like the CRISPR gene technology, where you can actually go in and cut out a gene that is known to create a disease, has potential in a disease process like this. So I think in a future state, Alan, we probably will see those therapies applied.
Thank you, Allie. All right. And now on to Jan in Middletown. Jan in Middletown, your turn.
Good afternoon, Alan and doctor. Thank you for taking my call. I have been diagnosed for a couple of years with Raynaud's disease. And when I look on the internet or I talk to the doctors, I'm pretty much told that there's nothing that can be done about the syndrome or disease. And not only are my hands and primarily my fingers and toes problematic, but I also have dry eyes, dry mouth, which from recent reading on the internet seems like it might be something else related to it.
Okay, so Jan, Jan, we got to
know of any cures. Does the doctor know of any treatment for Raynaud's disease?
Good question.
So, very simple answer to a complicated question, Jan. I think of these as in the autoimmune category. Raynaud's, for listeners, is a spasm of the arteries that generally occurs with cold exposure that will cause the hands and feet to become cold and sore, and frequently it will be associated with dry eyes and other rheumatologic issues. Generally, when one measures in the blood antibodies, they will turn out positive. And while there's no cure, and the current paradigm is to consider these often genetic, there are many things one can do to, I think, tame that immune system. And it might involve eliminating some foods like gluten-containing grains. It may involve working on the gut and what we call leaky gut, the permeability of the gut, which might involve taking some probiotics, getting a bit more fiber. So generally the approach would be to try to eliminate anything in the diet, to try to work on the biome of the gut, and often these inflammatory problems have their origins there. That would be a good start.
Thank you, Jan. Okay, we're going to take a break, as I said, and we'll be right back. So Rich and Harriet and Joseph and Bruce, hang on. And we are going around the horn now with our wonderful friend, Dr. Mark Pettis, who has so many titles, I don't know what to tell you. Triple board certified internist, nephrologist, integrative medicine physician, and he's been practicing for a long time. And director of medical education, wellness, and population health at Berkshire Health Systems. Associate dean of the medical education at the University of Massachusetts Medical School, and I could go on and on. Guy who knows what he's talking about. Okay, so we've got a Rich in Dingman's Ferry. All right, Rich, how are things over there in Dingman's Ferry?
Hi, thanks, you guys. Okay, so my thing is about sleep and the sleep circadian and the great essential involved with that, especially when it comes to my children, where it involves skin condition, the brain development, brain repair. And also remember that historically we've been told that guys, the great guys like Thomas Edison and Einstein, that these men were sleeping 2 and 3 hours a night or just napping intermittently throughout the day. So what's the rub on all that?
Well, sleep is one of the major pillars of health and health promotion. And while some people may be able to function on less sleep, most adults need 7 hours of sleep a night. And kids at a younger age, probably more, 8 to 9 hours, school age and younger. And as you alluded to, Rich, overnight sleep is when our diurnal circadian patterns restore, repair. It's when we consolidate our memories. It's when our brains are actually very active in terms of learning and processing. Our immune systems repair anything that needs to be repaired. So it's essential. The problem today, as I alluded to earlier, is the quality of light in our environment. We do not get enough natural light during the day. We get too much artificial blue-oriented light from our whether it's CFU bulbs or the smart devices that we use. And so being mindful of light, getting more natural light, full-spectrum light, an incandescent bulb or a halogen bulb will give you better light quality than a CFU, particularly later in the day. And then using these blue filters is also important. One last thing I'll say about sleep is our time is limited, Rich, but there's a lot of terrific research by a fellow named Sachin Panda, P-A-N-D-A. He's at the Salk Institute in Southern California. He's been looking for some time now at what is called time-restricted eating. It's taking what you would ordinarily eat, and most people graze throughout the day, an average of 15 hours or so while awake. If you restrict that to 10 to 12 hours, don't change what you're eating. Choose wisely, of course, but restrict that window to 10 to 12 hours during the day, not eating anything within a few hours of bedtime. That seems to have a dramatic impact on resynchronizing our circadian rhythm and restoring sleep. It's fascinating research.
Interesting. Thanks, Rich. Okay, and now on to Harriet in Pittsfield. Harriet in Pittsfield, go ahead.
Hello, thank you for taking my call.
Hi, Harriet.
I have recently read an article in the Bridgeport Daily Voice that says there's a chemical, which is, I think, in the earth where grains grow, and it says chemical in some breakfast cereals could cause cancer, and then it lists a whole bunch of cereals. And unfortunately, Cheerios and oatmeal are on that list. That's the only thing I eat for breakfast.
Yeah.
Have you heard of this study, and what's your opinion?
Well, this is a big story right now. If we're thinking of the same thing, Harriet, and what you're referring to is called glyphosate. Glyphosate is the active ingredient in Monsanto's Roundup. Roundup is an herbicide. And it is applied to both genetically modified crops like corn and soy, but it's also applied to grains to brown them. Farmers can apply glyphosate with a hastening of the browning and harvesting of those grains. And so oats and wheat and, many of these grains have very high levels of glyphosate. And even though Monsanto would suggest the jury is out on what the risks are, it's a real problem.
So should Harriet stop eating that stuff?
So I suggest to find alternatives to any grain-based breakfast food.
And that
may be a bit radical for some, but I think that's a health-promoting move anyway. It's a real problem.
I have four egg whites every morning.
Yeah.
That's what I do, and that's it.
And I would add the yolks to that, Alan.
But I know. So, hey, Harriet, thank you. Okay, we're coming down towards the end of the show. If you want to try to sneak in, you can. I want to read you one that came over the internet and I've been sitting on. Hello, doctors. I've been diagnosed with a degenerative disc. Welcome to the club, I say. Yeah. I'm in my early 50s. I am working on controlling my weight, strengthening my core, but I still have some work to do there. When I went to my primary, he said that I needed to get used to living in pain. I told him that ibuprofen has been giving relief, and he said to use ibuprofen to manage pain. I ingest approximately 800 to 1600 mg daily. I have concerns for long-term side effects to renal and cardiac processes to over time. Could you comment with your thoughts? In other words, that's something I think a lot of us who take some ibuprofen during the day, I know in my case, it upsets my stomach.
Yeah, and I think those are valid long-term concerns. There's certainly nothing wrong with ibuprofen for an acute injury, something that you might take for 2 to 4 weeks, 6 weeks. I think many of the things that this the person writing in noted, Alan, whether it be physical therapy and exercises on the core, if you look at things like yoga,
yep,
acupuncture, Tai Chi, there are many forms of therapy that involve connective tissue, soft tissue, the energy fields that support those. Those can all be very good longer-term treatments. And get some sunshine. You know, sunshine is very anti-inflammatory. You'll get a lot of vitamin D. We're in the sun season. You don't want to burn, of course, but a take-home message for today's broadcast is get more natural light. It helps everything.
Gotcha. And over to Bruce in Rhinebeck. Bruce in Rhinebeck, you're on.
Hi, I'm a 65-year-old male who, since his 40s, has had an inflammatory thing that happens over and over again. He's been diagnosed as psoriatic arthritis. It moves around in my body, the part that is suffering. It's not all the time. When I have it, I take some Indocin, and that seems to short-circuit it. I also had a clogged artery problem, bypass operation 5 years ago, even though my cholesterol and my diet have been excellent for my whole life. And I'm wondering if the inflammatory process was related to the clogging of the arteries. And I'm also wondering what can be done to mitigate inflammation. I've tried the diet things they recommend, and I can't tell that it helps at all.
Well, I do think, Bruce, that psoriatic arthritis and any chronic inflammatory state will affect one's risk for heart disease, which really is an inflammatory condition. And again, an elimination trial diet-wise, and I would look at a paleo approach in that example where I would be targeting grains and dairy, cow's milk, and those can be powerful pro-inflammatory foods that in the long term with elimination, people can feel tremendously better. Again, probiotics affecting the gut biome and getting more fiber from plant-based foods can also long-term affect inflammation. More natural light, better sleep hygiene with less blue light after sunset can help with inflammation. And then, sleep along with stress are important pillars of health and inflammation. So simple techniques, whether it be breath or guided imagery or yoga, prayer, can all be powerful in their anti-inflammatory effects.
Sounds like my Whole 30 diet is pretty current.
Very
right?
similar, Alan.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Bruce. All right. Let's go now to Joseph in Potown in Poughkeepsie. All right, Joseph, you're on.
Hello, gentlemen.
Hey, Joseph.
I am very impressed with the doctor's emphasis on health and nutrition. I looked at a program that talked about the blue zones. And quickly here, lastly, there was a lady who called concerning dry eye. I see a holistic optometrist. He does acupuncture. I think that could be a good place for her to start. Now, there's one in New Paltz.
Yeah, thank you, Joseph, for that comment. I couldn't agree more. And there are so many good ways to help the body reduce inflammation without having to rely on long-term pharmacology. And acupuncture is another good example.
We're trying to get them all in. And we're going to now to Stephanie in Kingston. All right, Stephanie, your turn.
Hello. The doctor recently mentioned leaky gut, and I was wondering if you could give me more information about what the symptoms are, how to heal it, or what treatment options there are.
Yeah, Alan and I could spend all afternoon talking about this, Stephanie. In short, leaky gut is when the permeability of the lining of the gut becomes compromised. So things pass through the lining into our system that otherwise would not have access. And because our immune system is predominantly in the lining of that system, when it starts to recognize things accessing it that don't belong there, it will become activated. So that inflammation from leaky gut may be experienced in the gut by way of reflux or a lot of bloating, gas, cramping, what some physicians might call irritable bowel syndrome. But inflammation in the gut can be experienced body-wide, and you might experience that as fatigue or rash or painful joints or just, brain fog, having trouble concentrating. So the approach would be to try to eliminate anything in your diet that may be provoking that. And again, this whole 30-day program that Alan alluded to is really kind of a paleo approach. I'd be eliminating grains and cow's milk for 30 days, getting more plant-based foods, probiotics, and then I would be looking at sleep hygiene, stress management, and there are many other things, but that would be a quick list of things to be thinking about.
Thank you, Stephanie. I'm moving right along in order to get everybody in. Let's go to Eric in Ashfield. Eric in Ashfield, your turn.
Hi there, can you hear me?
Yep. Yes.
Hi, just quickly, the woman who called about dry eye, I've had dry eye in one eye for several years, and my eye doctor told me there was nothing I could do except eye drops and trying to get more tears going. But then I went to my dermatologist, and this person said, here's how you treat your dermatitis in your eyebrows, just this, flaky skin in your eyebrows. Just a little bit of hydrocortisone in your eyebrows once in a while to keep that down. Ever since I started doing that, I've not had dry eye.
Interesting. And what is dry eye, Mark?
Dry eye is usually an inflammatory condition that affects the tear duct production of tears. So people just don't make enough tears.
Well, why is it annoying? Is it annoying?
It's annoying, exactly.
It's painful.
It can be painful when the eyes get really dry. It can affect vision. And cortisone is a mild anti-inflammatory, and that's a great suggestion.
Eric?
Yeah, I use 0.5%, not every day, just every few days. And I put it on different parts of my body. It doesn't matter. It doesn't have to be in the same spot. And actually, it shouldn't go in the same spot because it can weaken the skin and thin it.
Eric, got to go. Thank you very, very much. Okay, let's go to Don in Kingston. Don in Kingston, you're on.
Hi, how are you?
Hey.
So heard your discussion about grains being treated with glyphosate, a.k.a. Roundup. So the criminals in the ag industry and the food industry and the pesticide industry won't label products as containing GMOs. Can we not work against that by purchasing organic, which I believe implies that there are no GMOs used, and organic presumably also implies that glyphosate is not used? Is that a viable strategy to get clean food?
I wish it were true, Don. Without question, USDA organic and GMO-free labeling is the best reassurance one can have as to the cleanliness and quality of the food. That said, there's no mandated testing for glyphosate, and even organic grains. Farmers can use glyphosate for browning because it's not used in the agricultural production of the grain and can still label it organic, and that's a real problem.
Insane, because the plant is dead and doesn't have a chance to eliminate the product from through its own system. Thank you very much.
That's correct. Yeah, great question.
Thank you very much. Yeah. So we actually made it. It's now 2:57. We have a minute to chat. Is there anything you want to say that you think that we could all benefit from, Mark?
I really appreciate the caller's emphasis and interest and motivation to be looking for non-pharmacologic strategies to what they're going through, Alan. I think it speaks to the growing consensus of our consumers as to finding other ways. I would say if there was a theme today, it would be the importance of natural light. And the concern about junk light, artificial light. And so I would encourage people to look at Sachin Panda, P-A-N-D-A's work at the Salk Institute. There's some really good news to use. Time-restricted eating is another powerful, easy, accessible strategy that could totally kickstart health for almost anyone.
That's great. We are out of time. I want to thank Dr. Mark Pettis, who's always a wonderful addition to this program, of Berkshire Health Systems for being with us today. Support for Medical Monday comes from WMC Heart and Vascular Institute, with new diagnostic cardiology suites at Mid-Hudson Regional Hospital and Health Alliance Hospitals, members of the Westchester Medical Center Health Network, WMCHealth.org. Thanks to our brilliant engineer, Zach Malloy. Thanks to Joe Makowitz for answering the phones, our producers Jim Lavoulis, and I'm Alan Chartok. Thank you all for joining us on the Vox Pop. Stay tuned now after a little theme music for a news update.